You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Now, to start with, we have the sequel to physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham's hugely popular rundown of the top physics stories of 2012, which we're imaginatively calling
Ian Durham Strikes Back.
Well, I was going to go with Ian Durham's countdown of the top physics stories of 2013, but Ian Durham Strikes Back is a lot better, although it doesn't make him sound a lot scarier than he is.
Ian, I am your father.
I really don't think this is a time or place to be making such personal revelations, Brendan. Now back to the physics. You may remember that last year there was some controversy, as Ian went against pretty much every other physics list and did not choose the discovery of the Higgs boson as his number one news item.
I was quite surprised. Are there more surprises in store this year?
Oh, yes. In fact, before we even get to the fifth item on the top five, Ian began by listing a few of the physics stories that made the headlines this year, but didn't quite make the grade. Hello, Ian Durham, and thank you again for joining us for another year in physics roundup.
Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
And of course, you were with us in 2012 when we did a very similar roundup. And at that time, we did hope to meet again for this year's roundup, but we were also a little bit worried that we might all be killed in a kind of Mayan apocalypse that was predicted for 2012.
Indeed, and we nearly were, because there was a giant meteor that blew up over Chelyabinsk, Russia. It was a close call, but we're still here.
We're still here, so that's the first thing to say, I guess. We're just happy to be here. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about that meteor, because it was very, very dramatic. I guess it got a lot of people talking about, you know, how to track asteroids and whether we are all going to die at some point. So,
well, we are all going to die at some point.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's an accurate prediction there.
And I'm glad that nobody got seriously injured, but it was good because it got a lot of people talking about science. Certainly, it highlighted some of the threats that are out there, because nobody had picked up on this meteor, just this giant hunk of rock floating around, and even though we monitor such things, and it should have been in theory large enough to detect, nobody picked up on it. It made quite a spectacular explosion, and knocked out windows and garage doors, and online videos were quite impressive, and luckily it just happened to end up in a lake. But it does. It highlights some of the more dangerous aspects of living in the universe that we live in.
Right. So actually, the Russian meteor doesn't make your list of top five results of the year.
No, it doesn't.
There are a couple of other things that people might have thought could make your list, but, you know, you've been very discerning this year and very strict, and you've thrown out a couple of big results. So do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the kind of also-rans who haven't made the top five?
Sure. My criteria for doing the top five was I wanted it to be a breakthrough on the part of humanity in some sense. And I wanted it to be a positive breakthrough scientifically. So the Chelyabinsk meteor, we had nothing to do with that, so it didn't make my top five. The fact that we exceeded 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere also didn't make my list, because it's not a positive outcome. It certainly is a human thing, but it's not a positive outcome. But some of the more foundationally physics things that did not make my list, a lot of you may have heard of the amplituhedron.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Is a new multidimensional way of doing physics that is supposed to be better than some of the old ways, specifically particle physics. One of the things that particle physicists do a lot of is to calculate scattering cross-sections and things of that nature, and this is supposed to basically make it a little easier. At the moment, you have to compute these things called Feynman diagrams, and you have to compute a lot of them.
And just to clarify, so the amplituhedron, which has a really horrible, unfortunate name, but I guess it's some kind of, you know, it's been touted as kind of the jewel at the heart of quantum physics, and it's some kind of weird, I guess, multi-dimensional object that allows you to do some of these quantum calculations that you've been talking about by kind of mapping it to the volume of certain points in this object or something like that. It's kind of a geometrical way of simplifying specific calculations.
Correct. It's a geometric structure that basically simplifies how you calculate particle interactions. We like to think of geometry as being very visual, and indeed there is a visual element to this, but geometry can extend, just like all of mathematics, it can extend to many more dimensions than the human mind is capable of wrapping its head around. And that's kind of what the amplitudehedron does. It extends some of this stuff to higher dimensions, and so it's not quite geometry in the same sense that, you know, a high schooler would think of geometry. And this is supposed to make things easier. However, there's a little caveat to this. The amplitudehedron doesn't actually work in the real world yet. Hence, it didn't make my list. It offers some promising possibilities, but it's not mature enough. I'm a big believer, as much as I'm also a mathematician, I'm a big believer that physics has to be physical and real. Otherwise, it's just philosophy. So I think that one's got a little ways to go.
Right, okay. And then, you know, another one that's sort of very headline grabbing, and I have to admit I wrote an article about this one, and so I know that it really grabbed people's attention, was this idea that experiments have shown that you can reach negative absolute temperatures, which I think just puzzled everybody because the definition of absolute temperature is that you can't go below zero. So can you explain a little bit about, I mean, what that even means and why it's not worthy of being on your list?
So there are a couple of reasons it's not worthy of being on my list. I think there's a misunderstanding. People have a tendency to think a certain way about temperature. In particular, most average people use either the Fahrenheit scale or the Celsius scale to do temperature. Scientists actually use the Kelvin scale, which doesn't have an arbitrary zero point. So why is 0 degrees Celsius where it is? Well, it's the freezing melting point of water, which is, I suppose, not really arbitrary, but it's still rather arbitrary. I mean, you could, why not do the freezing melting point of metal, you know? The Kelvin scale is designed so that it's absolute. Absolute zero on the Kelvin scale is usually thought to be, well, they're sort of defined to be, a complete lack of energy. So objects that have energy in the universe have some temperature, and the only way to have zero temperature would be to have absolutely no energy whatsoever. However, temperature isn't really defined by the scale that it's measured on. Temperature is actually, it's defined based on an average of the energy. There are actually several ways to define it. You can define it in terms of the concept of entropy as well, and actually the relationship between entropy and energy. But basically, if you think about it this way, if you think about a bunch of gas molecules floating around in a room, and you were to take all these gas molecules and you were to say, all right, what's their average energy or average speed as they're moving around in a box or something like that? If there were no absolute zero, if absolute zero didn't exist, then you'd probably get something like a nice little bell curve. But because absolute zero exists, there's a sharp cutoff at one end. And that's how we define temperature. And by definition, then, a positive temperature is anything that falls on this energy scale. The way we have the temperature defined is it relies on this absolute bottom, you know, zero energy kind of thing. So what these guys did is they said, well, they kind of flipped the tables and said, well, what if there was an absolute maximum kind of thing, an absolute maximum kind of energy, and it flipped the entire plot around? Well, in that case, the signs of everything would just flip, and you'd have, by definition, a negative temperature. A bunch of gas molecules with a negative temperature would, by definition, have a negative pressure, which means they'd collapse in on themselves. But the thing is it's not really clear that there is an absolute, I mean, certainly there's nothing physically that says there has to be an absolute maximum universally. This is just in a very particular system that they defined this. So it's a bit of playing fast and loose with the language. I think it's a really great result, and it offers some fascinating possibilities for the future of materials and physics and things, but it's not as profound as everyone thinks it is.
Okay, well, fair enough. And
I don't know if You may have to edit that.
No, I like that. That was a good explanation, having banged my head against the desk trying to write a story about it myself. That was pretty good. I wish I'd spoken to you at the time. But actually, also, I guess earlier this month, there was a paper that came out in Nature Physics that kind of called into question, you know, all these claims about being able to create negative temperatures, and talks about sort of the definitions of entropy and the way that we kind of have to think about what's going on in these situations. So for those that are very excited about this story, I'll put a link to that paper on the website too, so you can go away and, I guess, look at more reasons why Ian's right not to put it onto his top five list.
Well, and again, I think you hit the nail on the head. In science, everything is, well, particularly in physics, you have to start somewhere, and one of the places you start is by defining your terms. And so we had to define temperature in a sensible way so that we could use it and repeatably use it. And the way it is currently defined, a negative temperature simply means, on an absolute scale, simply means that they've kind of flipped the graph around and that they're assuming that there's a hard and fast cutoff at the top end. It does not mean that these objects have a negative energy. And that's the important thing to remember. These objects absolutely don't. In fact, they have a very, very high energy.
Okay, and then one more before we actually get onto the list proper. And this one might really shock people because, well, I guess if they're fans of Physics World, which probably many of our listeners actually are, they might notice that this story that hasn't made your list was the number one on the list chosen by Physics World. So what is it, Ian, and why isn't it on your list?
So this is the Ice Cube Cosmic Neutrino Experiment. Basically, we've been detecting neutrinos since the late 60s, early 70s, and neutrinos have been theoretically around for a long time, but all the neutrinos we've ever detected have come, as far as we know, from the sun or from nuclear reactions on Earth. Cosmic neutrinos, so neutrinos that come from distant stars or the remnants of supernova explosions or whatever, have been harder to detect because of their energies. So neutrinos are notoriously difficult to detect because they only interact in one way. They interact via the weak nuclear interaction. There is no other way that they interact with anything. Meaning of the four fundamental interactions of nature, you know, gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak interactions. Weak is the only way they do it. And so it's very, very, very hard to detect them. And they're virtually massless. And the higher energy ones are even harder to detect. They just pass right through stuff all the time. So they had this thing called the Ice Cube Experiment down in Antarctica, where they buried a neutrino detector deep under the ice. And they were able to first observe neutrinos that they definitively were able to say were cosmic neutrinos. And while this is a really great advance, I think this is important. And it does, as they mentioned, it does herald a new era, I suppose, of neutrino astronomy, because right now, astronomy is entirely based on electromagnetic radiation, with maybe minor exceptions for astronomers who work on the solar wind and stuff like that. If you're looking at anything that's out of the solar system, or even most things in the solar system, you're observing through electromagnetic radiation, light, either whether it's visible light or X-rays or gamma rays or radio waves or microwaves, something like that. This would provide a different way to detect things, and it does have the advantage that neutrinos, because they go through all sorts of things, we could actually detect things that might not actually have been detected electromagnetically, because electromagnetic radiation can be absorbed by gas clouds and things like that, whereas neutrinos can't. So don't get me wrong, this is a really great discovery, and I think it came very, very close to my list. But the reason it didn't make the top five were, one, they talked about it ushering in an age of neutrino astrophysics. I would say that's a bit of a stretch because it's an enormous, enormous project. And to really develop neutrino astrophysics, somebody's got to find a way to detect cosmic neutrinos that isn't so amazingly expensive and massive of an undertaking and localized. Right now, we can only observe things using this observatory down at the South Pole, because that's where it is. So I think there's more that has to be done before this really makes a huge difference. While it's amazing that we got cosmic neutrinos, I think it's just not quite mature enough yet to say, wow, this is the big one. It's not, basically, I had five others that I thought were just a little bit better.
Okay, right. So now we've reached number five. We can now begin the official countdown. So what came in at number five?
Okay, so coming in at number five is an interesting story that came out of Simon Fraser University in Canada, and I guess with some assistance from some people in the UK and Germany. They managed to get a quantum state that lasted at room temperature for 39 minutes. Now, this is pretty impressive. So most quantum states don't really last that long because the quantum world is constantly in flux. There's always stuff going on. And in particular, quantum states, quantum things, are very susceptible to their environment. They're the touchiest things out there. If you have a piece of electronic equipment or your car and you think it's finicky, it does not even come close to as finicky as quantum states are. They don't tend to stay in one particular state for very long. In fact, the previous record up until this year was 2 seconds.
Okay.
And these guys got it to last for 39 minutes at room temperature. And at 4 Kelvin or so, I believe they actually got it to last for 3 hours. They even have a way set up, you could even literally put it in your pocket and walk around with it, and it wouldn't really decay all that much. So that is incredible. It's such a monumental jump from 2 seconds to 39 minutes. And what's impressive about this is that isolating quantum states, if you can get quantum states to stay the way they are for a long enough period of time, you can use them for things like quantum computers. So, for instance, quantum computers are based on the idea of being able to take a quantum state and manipulating. And in fact, these guys, what they did was they were isolating the nuclear spin of phosphorus. And by taking that and flipping the spin up or down, you can essentially get a qubit. And the problem with, you know, existing methods is that the qubits don't last very long in their state, so it's very hard to calculate much. You can calculate a few things, but it gets hard. But when you have a quantum state that lasts for 39 minutes, you can make some serious calculations in that time. That's a long time.
I've got a statistic here that I've pulled up, which says that they could perform more than 200 million operations in 39 minutes. So that is quite impressive, even though 39 minutes might not sound that long, I guess, when you just kind of say it like that. I mean, you wouldn't want your actual computer to stop working after 39 minutes or something, your laptop breaking down.
Yes, and it wouldn't be necessarily that the computer stopped working after 39 minutes. It would mean that you'd lose the coherence and the state itself would not be what it was. Which means it would be like having a bit inside your computer only hold its value for 39 minutes, which you could imagine would be a bit of a problem because it would be like you would be starting your computer from scratch, meaning like the day you bought it, every 39 minutes.
I had a Windows Vista laptop that actually did work like that. I had to kind of reinstall Windows every day.
Mac, right? So the thing is you could extract the information that you get out of the quantum computer and put it somewhere else once the 39 minutes is up, and then the computer will still work. You just have to reset the quantum state.
Do we know how they managed to do that? Because it's such a dramatic jump. It seems like they must have used some kind of new type of technique or some new trick. It's not just a case of kind of making small refinements to an existing technique. Or was
it? Yeah, what they did was they took phosphorus atoms that were in silicon. The other cool thing about this is that they did this in a semiconductor. So this is the kind of thing that has a lot of promise for the future of semiconductors. So you get silicon. Anytime you have a crystalline structure, you always have impurities in it, and you can also do what's called doping. You can add atoms to the lattice structure. So when you have phosphorus atoms that are in a silicon lattice structure, when they're at room temperature, they have a tendency to give up their electrons, and they become positively charged ions. They don't give them all up, but they give up some, so they become positively charged ions. When you remove those electrons, it eliminates a link between the nuclear spins and the surrounding electrical noise. So the spin of the nucleus is affected by all of the electrical noise from the electrons around it. But when you pull those electrons off, it's almost like a bare nucleus. It's not quite, but it's almost like that. And it doesn't get affected by the electrical noise that most atoms have. Now, of course, the problem is that when you remove these electrons, the nuclei become so well isolated that they can't be read or written to, meaning you've got this great qubit, but then as soon as, of course, being quantum mechanics, as soon as you do something with it, you change its state, right? So it's like, oh, darn. So to get around that problem, they first cool the crystal to a really, really low temperature, 4.2 Kelvin, and then they used some laser and radio pulses to put the atoms in a specific state. And this is, by the way, a very common way of doing this. Other groups have taken ions and used lasers to put them in specific states before. And that, so this is nothing new there. But then they could ionize the atoms before the crystal was warmed up to room temperatures. And so then once they sort of got it up to room temperature, it's almost like they could freeze it in the way it was set up. What this is really important for is the ability to store information in a quantum state. And bringing it up to room temperature, that's what allows it to kind of hold its state for 39 minutes. And then to get the information back out again, you've got to cool it back down and manipulate it. But in any case, I think that's just amazing because that's a huge leap forward in our ability as human beings to control things at the ultra-microscopic level. And that's just impressive. It's not something we've ever been able to do before. 2 seconds to 39 minutes is amazing.
So thank you to Ian Durham, a physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, for picking out a very worthy, record-breaking quantum achievement there to take fifth place. There's a link to the paper and a news story from the Oxford Quantum website about their experimental feat on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. So, what's at number four?
I'm afraid, Brendan, for that you'll have to tune in to the next podcast.
Oh no, a cliffhanger.
Yes, sorry about that. So, stay tuned. In the meantime, thank you to Sarah Seeger and Colin Stewart.
And of course to Darth Durham.
Ian Durham. He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.